Nicola, it'd be great to have that passage open. We're going to be looking at it fairly closely today. And looking right through from chapter 2 of Romans to verse 20 of chapter 3. I'm going to need your help to start off with. Yesterday's group did all right at this. I think you guys can do better. Who knows the game King Caratnicus?
Yeah.
All right, so it's enough people will hopefully draw the crowd along. King Caratnicus has lost his considering cap. Some say this, some say that, but I say it was team number one.
Not I, sir.
Team number one stand up and say, not I, sir. Then who, sir?
Team number two, sir.
Team number two. Team number two is going to stand up and say,
not I, sir. Well,
then who, sir?
Team number three, sir.
Not I,
sir. Then who, sir?
Oh.
Number two around.
We just lost a couple of teams in the process. That is King Caratnicus. I once had a game of that going with about 150 year 12s in a room not much bigger than this, and they've like crammed lines jammed in, and it was insane. Like, as they yelled out, not I, sir, then who, sir? It was just in crazy noise echoing around the room to the point where I'm like, I've got to get out of here. Like, this is hurting my ears. And as they stood and up and down, there's this wave rolling across the room. It was crazy. Wouldn't it be cool if life worked like King Caratnicus? Who did it? Not I, sir. Well, then just blame someone else. Then who, sir? Them. Doesn't matter. No reason, no excuses. Just pass the blame. Pass the buck to someone else. You know, some people actually try this. You might even call some adults who try this. I don't know whether you can call this guy an adult, though. He's a quote from Bieber. A cop pulled him over and he said, cop pulled me over and threatened to give me a ticket. I told him to Google me. Laws don't apply to me. I love the comment at the bottom. I have an idea, son. Why don't we drive to the nearest cliff and see if the law of gravity applies to you? And there was multiple comments like that in the thread that went down below. Wouldn't it be great if we could get out of things that easily? You know, we can kind of bag out Bieber. But don't we all love to think that we're in the right? You know, anything. It's not my fault. I didn't do it. The dog ate my homework. It was 11:59 on the clock on my computer, so I submitted my assignment on time. When it doesn't make it in. Someone else did it. We can think the rules don't apply to us. We find an exemption wherever we possibly can. So I was talking to the med students on Monday night about sharing this talk. I asked them, have you guys got any good exemption stories? And all of them had a story about how something did not apply to them in instances where it actually did. So they, you know, meant to do something in the hospital, meant to stay for a certain amount of time, but they know the student who, or the year above them student who's now a registrar who will let them off. And all of them had no problem coming up with examples like that. We love the idea of an exemption, that thinking things don't apply to us. We're looking at Romans chapter 2 and 3. And if you've just joined us today, if you missed last week, we're in this series of Romans, where Paul's talking to a bunch of Christians around different churches in Rome. And last week he introduced this central idea of the gospel, that it's the power of God for the salvation of those who believe. First for the Jew and then to the Gentile. That's chapter 1 and verse 16. And the rest of that first chapter of Romans 1 lays out the problem. The problem for which we need a solution. We saw the problem in verse 18 of chapter 1. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. That's the problem. The problem is God's right and proper response to people's rejection of him. Their suppression of truth, squashing the idea of the knowledge of God, his reality, his divinity, and worshipping created things instead of the Creator. And throughout the second part of that chapter, of chapter 1, there's kind of this distance that's created between the people Paul is talking to and about. He's talking to groups of people. We see it on the screen. Everyone. The Jew, the righteous, people. To them. There. Those people. this people who've been engaging in sexual immorality, idol worship, malicious talking to one another. But in chapter 2, what do you notice? Chapter 2, verse 1, what changes? Therefore, you have no excuse. Every one of you who judges. Paul seems to be addressing people here who are assuming they're exempt from God's just and fair condemnation. You know, hearing chapter 1 and thinking to themselves, oh, it's not for us, it's coming to those people, them. I'm glad that's not our predicament. You know, we're not like those people, sexually immoral, idol worshippers, and that's not us. And in some part, we might be right to think like that. The Jews at that particular time weren't particularly known for things like sexual immorality and idol worship. But that's not a reasonable excuse. Because verse 1, you who judge others do the same things. Now maybe it wasn't the publicly immoral things, making statues of gods to worship, but greed, deceit, boastfulness, sins of pride, looking down on, condemning other people, condemning those sinners. They're not exempt from that. And surely we're not exempt from that either. See, maybe you, like me, think deep down, I know better. We know better. I'm not like those classmates who do those things. I've got a higher moral standard. You may not say it like that, but do we think it? Do we live up to even our own expectations, our own standards of righteousness in what we say, in our patience, in our expectations of how we deal with things like anger, in our complaining or being content? Do we live up to our own expectations in what we watch on various screens, in what we replay in our minds, those things that no one else sees? And particularly as these verses are highlighting, do we judge others? See, this isn't just about discerning right from wrong, wise from unwise. It's that self-righteousness that condemns unrighteousness. Thinking, I'm not like that. I don't do that, those things. And I don't think I'm unique in being able to come up with those illustrations really quickly and examples really quickly. Because I think we all think like that at times. See verse 3? I don't think God thinks I'm unique in thinking those things either. Verse 3, do you really think any one of you who judges those who do such things yet do the same, that you will escape God's judgment? Or verse 4, do you presume on the riches of his kindness and forbearance and patience, not knowing that God's kindness is meant to lead you to repentance? See, God's kindness, God's tolerating of sin so as not to act immediately in judgment, that kindness is actually leading people to continue to sin, to keep rejecting God. See, what's going on here, what he's illustrating is like a grand scale version of the parents' 10, 9, 8 countdown. Ignoring it. The child ignoring it. You know, the parent saying, 10. No, no, we need to get out of the bath soon. No, no, no. 9. No, stop hitting your brother. 8. No, 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 stop drinking the water. No, you can't. 7. The soap does not go there. Right down to 3. 2. And the child just continuing as if the zero will just never come. The parent's patience will just never run out. Happens in our household every night, around 6 p.m. No hitting. Time to get out. 3, 2. See, God had chosen Israel. They were his people, his children, the object of his blessing, that they might live for his praise. And yet continually throughout the Old Testament, what do we see? Crafting false gods, turning to idols, seeking to be like the other nations, ignoring God's law repeatedly. And so God starts counting down as an expression of his kindness. 10, he warns them. 9, he tolerates their sin. 8, he warns them with some kind of partial judgment. He shows he's for real. 3, 2, he rescues many of them from themselves. He reminds them of his kindness. See, in his tolerance, God shows his desire that they might turn back to him and be saved. But verse 5, because of your stubbornness and unrepentant heart, you are storing up wrath for yourself on the day of wrath, when God's righteous judgment will be revealed. 0 will come on the day of Jesus' return. And already people are accumulating God's just consequences. You know, whether we're more like the public sinners or the private sinners, the result's the same. Whether it's our unrighteousness or our self-righteousness, both fail at aligning with God's righteousness, his perfect standard, which means for all humanity, when 0 comes and God's right and proper and completely justified anger is displayed for all to see, we won't just see it. Without any kind of solution, we'll feel it. It will be close. It won't be at a distance. We will be the you, those without excuse. And at this point in Romans 2, you can kind of hear the murmurs, the objectors in the crowd who are hearing this. Maybe your voice is amongst them. You know, for the Jews, it's, what about my status? What about my Jewishness? Aren't I exempt? And Paul seems to anticipate these kinds of objections. The first one, no one is exempt. Point 2 on your outlines. This first objection Paul expects is to do with the basis for God's judgment. You know, we can imagine the thought, if we're God's people, how can it be fair for God to judge us on the same basis that he judges everyone else, non-Jews? It's the assumption of privilege. It's Bieber's assumption. God should just Google the Jews, right? And then he'll see. He'll remember who they are. What's Paul's response? From verse 6 and verse 11, we see it laid out like this. God will repay each one according to his works, for there's no favoritism with God. God doesn't judge by external circumstances, outward appearance, national affiliation. No, God judges in accordance with works, what they have done. See, what Paul's doing here is he's drawing on their Jewish knowledge. This is a statement resembling Psalm 62. And other places in the Old Testament, in their book, which they would agree with and know. And so they'd think, well, if that applied to, he's saying, if that applied to them, well, you're not exempt either now. If it's true then, it's true now. God hasn't changed. God hasn't started judging by some new standard. And verse 7 and 10 give us the details of what this looks like on the positive side. And verse 8 and 9, the opposite. Do you see what Paul's trying to show the Jews here? Trying to show us? It's the same deal for everyone. Which means it's the same deal for us too. Whether it's the same deal for Jews and Greeks, same deal for us too. Yes, there'll be those who are saved first and those who are saved second. And there'll be those who are judged first and judged second. But the two go together. You can't have one without the other. So if the Jews might feel privileged, well, we're the first to be saved, they also need to admit that, well, they're going to be the first to be judged. The deal is the same because God doesn't play favourites. But weren't the Jews the recipients of God's law? Like, aren't they really in the same boat as the Gentiles? Are they really in the same boat as the Gentiles? Can both groups really be judged by the same standards? And one received the law and the other didn't. How does that work? Well, that's the objection Paul seems to be assuming from verse 12. All those who sinned without the law will also perish without the law. And all those who sinned under the law will be judged by the law. What law is Paul talking about here? What law is he talking about? So we'll see from the rest of Romans and in line with his other writings, when Paul talks about the law, he's primarily talking about the Mosaic law, the Torah, the first five books of the Bible. The law that God gave Moses 430 or so years after the promises to Abraham. And so the Jews might like the start of verse 12. All those who sin without the law will also perish without the law. Yes, you can hear them saying. But who is Paul's target here? It's not them. It's those who sin under the law. The end of the sentence. Those who break God's law. They too will be judged. They too will perish. See, just having the law does not act as some kind of magic protection for them. Verse 13, for the hearers of the law are not righteous before God, but the doers of the law will be declared righteous. See, doing what God desires, that is the standard of his assessment. Not simply knowing what he desires. But again, how is that fair? Gentiles don't have access to the law, so how can they know? Well, it's kind of right, isn't it? But only kind of. See verse 14? They regularly conform, do by nature things required by the law, like not murdering or stealing. And so deep down, what they're showing is that they do actually know God's law. God's standard. It's written on their conscience because they, just like the Jew, have been made by him, made by God, and so they know. And so based on that, their obedience to God's law or their failure to obey will be judged. Verse 16, on the day when God judges what peoples have kept secret through Jesus Christ, they'll be judged. I want you to imagine a Queenslander driving into New South Wales this week. Seeing a cop car on the side of the road with its sirens on and lights flashing. The Queenslander hasn't received the news, maybe you haven't either. That's now illegal if you don't slow down to 40 when you pass them. That cop car. But if that Queenslander thinks driving up, you know, like a good Queenslander, well, it's dangerous if I don't slow down here. They don't know the law, but they slow down to make things safer for the police officer and those around. Have they obeyed the law in that instance? Well, of course they have, even though they didn't know it. But what if they thought, well, I should slow down here, because this looks like a bit of a dangerous situation. There's people by the side of the road, there's a police car, lights flashing, and they just continued on their way at the same speed. See, in the language of verse 15, the principle of protecting our fellow humans that informs a law like that, that's actually written on their conscience. And so by disregarding that, their conscience is now their accuser. And so as Paul's argument goes, as this illustration goes, which state are you from? You know, clearly Queensland is the better state. Nail my colours to the mast. But is that where we're from in this illustration? Are we people who know the details, or sorry, don't know the details of God's law, but do know what God wants deep down in our conscience, even though we do suppress that? Are we Queenslanders in the illustration? Or are we from New South Wales knowing this law like the Jews? Paul's addressing here. Who are we? Well, I think living here and now, sitting here and now, we're kind of both. But if anything, aren't we actually more like the Jews in the illustration? More like the New South Welshman? Knowing God's ways, we have his word, we have free access to it. So what does that mean for us? When zero comes, when Jesus will return to judge the world. See, even our possible excuse of not knowing is rendered useless. Not that it was a particularly great excuse anyway, because what's the main point of this whole section? It's that Jews and Gentiles are actually both going to be judged by the same standard, because the standard is not knowing the law, it's obedience. And even non-Jews have this law written on their hearts. But again, no one wants to hear this, do they? No one wants to hear this. And so again, there's objections to the argument, especially if you're a Jew. And Paul anticipates these, and in the next two sections, 3 and 4 on your outline, we get two of them. First one is, what about my Jewishness? From verse 17. This is basically the objection that Paul's forgotten the whole Old Testament. That he's forgotten the promises of God to Abraham to grow him into a great nation, a great people, the Jews. See, Paul here seems to be ignoring the special privileged status that the Jews had in God's plan. And so how does he respond? Well, from verse 17, he lays out this great list of Jewish privileges, revolving mainly around them having the law. Have a look at them on the slide. Their status, that they're Jewish, they're Jews, they belong to God. Their wisdom, what they know, particularly from the law. And their teaching, that they see themselves as a guide, as a light, because they have the law. They can teach. And what might be a little bit surprising is actually all of these things are reasonable. Lots of them are how God's chosen people are described, that they're how they're meant to live, how they're encouraged to live. Paul's not being sarcastic here. He's not even overstating the point. What he's doing is he's setting them up. You know, they nod and smile at this great list of who they are, their teaching and their wisdom, their status. And then he asks them these questions. You who teach, do you teach yourself? Do you steal? Do you commit adultery? Do you rob temples? Do you dishonor God? Their actions don't actually match their talk. Notice how these questions move in the opposite direction to the first list. Paul's leading up to that final point of, do you dishonor God? And the answer is clearly, yes, they do. Despite their teaching, despite their wisdom, despite their status, their privilege, they dishonor God. Verse 24. Far from being some kind of light and guide to the Gentiles, as it is written, the name of God is blasphemed among the Gentiles because of you. See, the differences that they enjoy, their great status, their superior wisdom, they're no place for them to put their confidence. No place for them to hold out hope in. And so from verse 25 to 29, he then goes on to illustrate this. With one example, the example of circumcision. He comes back to it later in the book, and basically the point is that circumcision is only a sign. It's not a free, well, somewhat painful, ticket out of judgment. Circumcision is only a sign. You know, like my wedding ring, just a sign. It points to the fact that I am married, I'm covenanted to life with Laurel. But that ring is not Laurel. It's not a guarantee in itself. This is not marriage. Marriage is our promises. Marriage is choosing to stick to those promises. Which is a good thing that this isn't marriage, because I lost my first one. Out in the ocean somewhere off Newcastle. It's probably on the bottom. See, if God's chosen people don't keep their side of the promise, verse 25, if they are lawbreakers, well then, their circumcision has become uncircumcision. See, whether anyone can actually do this perfect obedience of the law is not Paul's point here. It's a hypothetical. It's if someone could fully obey the law, well then they'd be insiders. They'd be considered the group who are the circumcised, righteous in God's sight. It's a hint of what's to come in Romans. Paul is redefining Jewishness here as heartfelt obedience as verse 29, lives that are inspired by and motivated by God himself, his spirit, not the letter, the Mosaic law. And the next objection then flows out of this one. See, if all that is true, what advantage then is there in being a Jew in the national Israelite sense? You know, if there's no difference, Jew and Gentile alike, there must be no advantage, right? Point four. No difference, no advantage, right? 3 verse 1. So what advantage does the Jew have? Or what is the benefit of circumcision? Considerable in every way. Much in every way, as the NIV puts it. It's kind of surprising, isn't it? Kind of sounds a bit contradictory. What's the advantage? Verse 2. First of all, they have been entrusted with the very words of God. So we can imagine Gentile readers listening to chapter 2 and proudly thinking to themselves, well, God must be now revoking that great list of Jewish privileges. But their past advantages actually still stand. They have God's special revelation of himself in the law, not just the general revelation in creation. But verse 3, there's more objections. What if some did not believe? Will their unbelief cancel God's faithfulness? Absolutely not, says Paul. God must be true, even if everyone is a liar. It's a bit strange the way he kind of puts these things forward, these objections. But what he's doing here, I think, is responding to the belief that God's always faithful to his promises, even if people disobey. And so because God promised blessing to the Jews, well, they'll then be immune from judgment, whatever they do. In a sense, it's the argument that there's no cancel button on God's promises. And on that point, they're kind of right. But what they forget is that the promised blessing is actually contingent on their obedience. It's always been contingent on their obedience. And on that score, they've failed. They've been unrighteous, self-righteous. And so God is right to judge them. His faithfulness applies to judgment, not just to blessing. It goes both ways. Which raises a bunch more objections in verse 5 to 8, but for the sake of time, we'll pass over them today. And return to the big question of this kind of mini section. Is there a difference? Is there any advantage in hearing how God wants people to live, in having the law? What have we seen? Yes, there's some privilege in that, to have God's word, to have his promises, but the privilege is limited. It's still conditional on obedience. You know, you can't just pull a Bieber and claim that you're above the law. No one can have God's faithfulness to get blessing without also having God's faithfulness to be judged if they disobey. Which leads Paul all the way back to where he started, start of chapter 2 and even further back into the middle of chapter 1. We see it, point 5 on your outline, from verse 9 of chapter 3. We have no excuse. What then? Are we any better? Not at all. For we have previously charged that both Jews and Gentiles are all under sin. Both have the same problem. Both are under the same predicament. Chapter 1 highlighted the actions of the non-Jews, but it's not just them. The Jews also, for all their privileges, are not exempt from God's righteous judgment either. See, both groups here, they're not just people who sin, they're actually under sin. Did you notice that? They're subject to its power and to the consequences of that. See, sin is this universal problem that even devout Judaism cannot overcome. Another solution is needed. Because verse 10, the evidence is clear. This section from verse 10 through to verse 18, it's kind of like a picture a courtroom. We're in a good spot here to picture it. I should be standing up the other end, really. And you can picture the lawyer, the kind of prosecuting attorney, maybe standing over there, looking at the suspect, all the suspects, including us. And the lawyer opens to the book of the Psalms to text that originally were directed to the wicked enemies of the Jewish people. And then he looks to the suspects, to us, and begins quoting from them. There is no one righteous, not even one. There is no one who understands. There is no one who seeks God. All have turned away. All alike have become useless. There is no one who does good, not even one. And then he lays out the evidence from verse 13. Their tongues, their throats, their lips, their speech, or their feet that are swift to shed blood, violence, all of which prove the point. Verse 18, that there is no fear of God before their eyes. And so the consequence, the conclusion of these three chapters, this great courtroom scene, is the suspect sitting there, the accused sitting there, and being silent. No excuse, no words. Verse 19, halfway through, every mouth may be shut, and the whole world may become subject to God's judgment. Gentiles, and now Jews as well, everyone, us included. No defense, no excuse, no words before God. Not even great attempts at law obedience. For verse 20, no one will be justified in God's sight by the works of the law, because the knowledge of sin comes through the law. God's standard, God's judgment is based on works, but no one will be declared right with God by doing them, because no one does them completely. And so where does this leave us? In the courtroom. The accused. Do we have some kind of exemption? Now, if the Jews have no excuse, the privileged have no excuse, how are we placed? A bunch of years ago, I left church of a Sunday night in Sydney. It's just about 200 metres back from this intersection where I used to go to church. And it was about 10 p.m. at night. I'd been hanging around after supper. And I came up to this set of traffic lights. And at about this point where the photo's taken, I blacked out. I drove through that intersection, a red light at the time. And I was coming straight up to what you can't see behind the truck, where the road diverges and there's a concrete wall with some one of those kind of compression barriers at the midpoint. What got me back from that, why I didn't hit that barrier, was a red light camera. Flash. I don't know whether it was a microsleep or something else. Around the time I was having chronic headaches and some low blood pressure issues, and I had blacked out before, like that. And so I sent a letter off to the police, or to the sheriff's office, when the $312 fine came. And I got the doctor to write part of the letter and talk about the condition that they're investigating. And the letter came back, no exemption. But you can keep your license. And I lost 3 demerit points as well. Yeah, $312 to a uni student at the time, that's like millions, right? I want some kind of exemption from God's judgment. But what's my exemption? What's our exemption? We do good things. We're not bad all of the time. We're better than those around us. Yeah, sometimes, to some extent, those things might well be true. But are they actually also signs of another problem? Instead of unrighteousness, it's self-righteousness. Our hearts not seeking God, but seeking self-justification. On Monday night, I was reading Proverbs, some of the passages you guys have been reading in your engage groups. Verses like, a wise man will listen and increase his learning. A discerning man will obtain guidance. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge. Fools despise wisdom and discipline. For the one who finds me finds life and obtains favour from the Lord. But the one who misses me harms himself. All who hate me love death. And I found myself sitting there thinking, that's me. I'm positioning myself with the wise. And then I read Romans 3 again, quoting the psalmist, There is no fear of God before his eyes. That psalm continues, for in his own eyes he flatters himself too much to detect or hate his own sin, committing himself to a sinful course and does not reject what is wrong. The psalmist is describing the wicked, and here it's applied to everyone. See, without Jesus, without a solution to this problem, we all suppress the truth about God, which leads us to suppress the truth about ourselves. Humans aren't people who simply commit sins, we're under sin. It's an enslavement. We're prisoners to it, under its reign, under its rule. Sin is our master. And there's no suitable exemption we can write off and get. If we fail to recognise this, we'll apply the wrong solution to the problem. You know, if we think the basic human problem is, say, ignorance, what solution will we apply? More education. Does education get a slave, a child slave, out of slavery? It might be helpful once they're out, but does it get them out? No, what do they need? They need a ransom. They need a rescuer. They need a whole new master. And that's us too. We need a rescuer. We need a ransom. We need a new master. We need the rest of Romans chapter 3. We need next week's talk. And if you are, like me, someone who knows the rest of Romans 3 and believes it, knows this rescuer, this ransom, this new master, we must not, like the Jews did, show contempt for the riches of God's kindness. We must not forget the size of the problem, because if we do that, we'll underestimate the size of the solution. We'll continue to be subject to God's righteous anger. Don't underestimate the size of the problem. And look to Jesus, the great solution. We need a new rescuer. We need a ransom. We need a master. We need next week. Let me pray. God, thank you for the clarity of this text, that you speak to us and tell us the size of the problem. We thank you that you're clear on our status before you. And we thank you that next week will come, that we can read Romans 3:21 and we can look to the solution, the master, the ransom, the rescuer. Amen.